This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Occasionally, we like to feature interviews with some of the journalists whose work you know from National Public Radio. Daniel Schorr is NPR's senior news analyst. Schorr worked for CBS from 1953 to 1976. He was brought there by Edward R. Murrow. He covered Watergate for CBS, and that landed him on Nixon's enemies list. He left the network after a falling out with CBS over the publication of a suppressed House Intelligence Committee report, which had been leaked to Schorr. From 1979 to 85, Schorr was CNN's senior Washington correspondent. I asked Dan Schorr about one of the most dramatic moments of his career, which occurred during CBS's live coverage of the Watergate hearings.
Here was John Dean testifying in June 1973 before Senator Ervin's Watergate Committee. And in his testimony, he said that at the White House they had drawn up something called enemies lists, but he didn't read them, so that we waited until the end of the session to get the first copies of what had been submitted in evidence. And there we were outside the Senate caucus room waiting for the hearing to break so that we could get on the air. I say we, Sam Donaldson of ABC and Douglas Kiker of NBC and myself, standing more or less shoulder to shoulder and talking into our own cameras, each wanting to be 2 or 3 seconds ahead of the other in revealing whom the Nixon people considered to be enemies. And so the thing was handed to me live on television. And I said, here it is, the first of the enemies list from John Dean. It's headed on screwing up political enemies. And let me kind of read it to you. I see there 20 numbered names. And went down the list and came indeed, as you suggested, to number 17, where it said, Daniel Schorr, a real media enemy. And I kind of gulped and went right down to the next name and down to the last name, which was Mary McGrory, and said, now back to you, trying as hard as I could to pretend that my name belonged to somebody else because I had suddenly been dragged into the story I was covering. And that is, for me, a real no-no. I mean, I want to stand outside, and they had pulled me inside.
Okay, so you tried to not reveal what you were feeling on the air, but what is it that you were feeling when you came up to number 17?
Well, what I was feeling, I mean, it didn't really bother me that I was on the enemies list, although it didn't occur to me that I was important enough in their terms to get on the enemies list. So astonished was the word for it, but much more because I had such a long life in journalism, from print to radio to television and all, that my standards were being violated. I'm supposed to be the observer, the fly on the wall, and suddenly I had to say my own name as part of the story that I was covering, and somehow the electrifying effect of having to deal with that professional problem overcame everything else.
Some people who made it onto that enemies list considered it a badge of honor, did you?
Oh, yes. Well, a badge of honor. It turned out to be very useful. First of all, by the time I was aware of the enemies list, I knew nothing ever was going to happen about it, although I had been audited rather curiously by the IRS. But yes, it was. There were buttons handed out by some well-meaning people that read Dean's List. And after a while, I found it was increasing my invitations to dinner parties that I like to go to and adding to my lecture fee. So, you know, as I recall, you know.
Boy, did they do you a favor.
Yeah, did they do me. And some of my colleagues who were not on the enemies list came to be a little resentful. Dan Rather, who had been covering the White House then, somehow didn't make it on the enemies list, and he didn't like that at all.
Now, President Nixon also ordered an FBI investigation of you on the pretext that you were in line for a top federal job, so of course they had to investigate you. How did you find out about this investigation?
Well, very simply, he had Haldeman have his assistant, Larry Higby, call J. Edgar Hoover and simply say, the boss, the president, wants to have some background stuff on correspondent named Daniel Schorr. And apparently Hoover misunderstood, either really misunderstood or maybe mischievously chose to misunderstand. The word background is used by the FBI, is commonly used for background checks on people who are going to be nominated to presidential positions, presidential appointments. And so there apparently was some misunderstanding, with the result that the investigation that was ordered by Hoover was basically a wide-open investigation in which agents called up my employer, called up members of my family, and indeed sent an FBI agent up to CBS to interview me. And when I said, what is this all about, he said, presumably you know, these are usually done for pre-appointment investigations. I said, but nobody's offered me anything. When the word got back that this had happened, they quickly and rather precipitously called off the investigation and then began to have a damage control meeting as to what to do when the story came out. And so all those wonderful people, Ron Ziegler and Chuck Colson, all got together and they said, well, there's the only thing we can do is to say that he was under consideration for a job, however preposterous that may seem, and actually identify a job.
What job did they come up with for
it
you?
Was a public relations person for the Council on Environmental Quality, which was then headed by Russell Train, who a long time later apologized to me profusely because he knew that he had been used for that purpose. You want me to tell you how that story ended many years later?
Sure.
Well, the interesting thing was that in the months before his death, Nixon and I had a reconciliation of sorts. I found myself being invited to small dinners where Nixon was giving briefings on his trips to the former Soviet Union. And at one of these, the first of these dinners, I was wondering if he remembered who I was or why I was being invited, and unable to resist that temptation, at the end of dinner, I went up to Nixon and I said, Mr. Nixon, I'm not sure you will remember me, but... And he interrupted me and he said, oh, sure, Dan, sure. Damn near hired you once.
Did he believe that?
No, he didn't believe that. That was his little joking way of trying to make up. I don't know. It was a quip. He said it with a smile. And I'm sure he had worked it out in his mind that he was going to say it to me. But the fact of the matter was he wanted... To be forgiven or forgotten or whatever, and I found it not difficult to do that.
Daniel Schorr, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your early years, your coming of age, and your start in journalism. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the neighborhood you grew up in.
Well, I grew up in the Bronx in a semi-poor but respectable neighborhood. From a very early age, as far as I can even remember, journalism was all I wanted to do. And I remember the first money I earned from journalism when I was about 13 years old. We lived on the ground floor of a tenement. And one day I heard a big plop outside the window and looked out the window, and lying there was somebody who had fallen or jumped off the roof. And so cool as a reporter ought to be, I waited for police to arrive, found out what I could, and called a local newspaper, which paid $5 for news tips and dictated a story. And that was really, in a sense, a benchmark for what was to be my career, in that if you can see something which might make you, which might affect you, and find yourself not affected except wanting to know what it's all about so you can explain it to other people, I think that's the basis of a journalistic career. It is removing yourself from drama so you can describe the drama.
Were your parents immigrants, or were they born? So did they speak English well?
No. Well, I really don't remember how well my father spoke English, because I was about 5 when he died, and I have very little memory of that. My mother spoke with an accent for all of her life, although she pretty well educated herself and read a great deal and was very literate. But that accent remains. I guess maybe this is the time even to reveal that our name when my parents arrived in New York from Russia was not even Schorr. It was a different name. My father gave his name on arrival. The officer said, what's your name? And my father gave it. The name was Chornomorets, which in Russian means Black Sea. And the immigration officer asked for it a couple of times, some of my mother told me, and unable to write it down, write down Schorr, Schorr, and said, Mr. Schorr, welcome to America.
How did your parents feel about the name change? Did your mother care?
Well, I don't think so. Understand, the process of Americanization involved a great deal of casting off old things and acquiring America all of a sudden. And so while I don't think my parents would have voluntarily and on their own changed their name, and if they hadn't, I could just see myself with how many sign-offs, this is Daniel Chornomorets in Moscow or whatever. I think they accepted it as a part of the price of admission into this wonderful country.
Did you feel in a way that you had to be a journalist for your mother? A lot of a lot of times when a kid is growing up who was born in America, sometimes that kid has to translate not only the language but a lot of the culture for the parent.
Well, that's right, and journalism didn't transfer very well into their culture. When my mother asked me at about 13, 14 what I wanted to be, and I said a journalist, she looked at me very disapprovingly. So you don't want something like lawyer or doctor with a degree, which is what Jewish kids did, you know, lawyer, doctor, those were the two things. And journalists didn't carry a degree. And in fact, I recall my mother saying to me, journalist, isn't that a little bit like show business? at that time.
Little did she know.
Little did she know. But I said yes, and she came to accept it. She came actually to be a little proud of it. She came to understand that journalism was A, respectable, and B, that you can make a living at it, more important.
You know, this innate feeling that it was your job to detach yourself from what was happening and describe it, did that apply to very emotional things that were happening to you, too? Did you find yourself trying to distance yourself from that and describe it as well?
Well, that's interesting. That's interesting. It maybe gets us deeper into psyche than I really plan to go. But since you ask, I've wondered myself about it. I've wondered myself about this dispassionate, disinterested view that I have of world and dramatic events and sometimes tragic events. And wonder whether, unable to come to terms with the death of my father when I was very young, that I was able then to deal with my father's death by removing myself from it, and thus learned to remove myself from a great many painful things.
I think it was in 1953 that you were recruited by Edward R. Murrow for the CBS news team. I mean, this is the most celebrated news team in television history. What was it like for you? Did it feel worthy of the celebration?
Well, that was interesting, too. I had that. This is 1953, and I was working in Western Europe, living in Holland, working in Western Europe as a stringer for various New York Times, for Time magazine, and for CBS. And Murrow was impressed. He sent a cable, which read, "Would you at all consider joining the staff of CBS with an initial assignment in Washington?" And I can remember the first time I appeared on that show. I'd just come back from Moscow, and appeared on this ad lib show of an hour and a half. And when we just finished taping it, I was sitting there at the Circle. Murrow sort of walked over and looked at me. He's a very understated man. Walked over and looked at me and said, "Sure, you'll do."
Did that feel really good?
That felt very, very good.
Through all your career as a reporter, you tried to keep yourself out of the story. And as an analyst, I mean, your thoughts are the story. Your analysis is the story.
But not my emotions.
But not your emotions. Right, right.
And I think that to sort of anticipate your question, but if I haven't anticipated right, you'll tell me. I think that news analysis goes along with objective journalism. Mm-hmm. As long as you say the way you think things are instead of the way you want things to be. And I think that the information has become simply altogether too complex for people to be able to understand without some help from people with backgrounds. So I don't regard news analysis on NPR or anywhere as being different from what I consider to be the objective journalism, which has been my idol.
So in other words, you're saying that you see analysis as being in part about synthesis, so that to help people make sense of a lot of facts and put them in some kind
of
context?
That's right. In the CNN age, in the age of CNN, where things are brought to you live, you can see happening everything that's happening and have everything there except understanding what it means. And I think the more live news people get, the more they need help in understanding it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Daniel Schorr is senior news analyst for National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air.